Hi, Sonny.
I love that sweater.
Oh, really?
No.
I've had this sweater since eighth grade.
What?
Actually, it's funny that you mention it because today I was in a board meeting for my record label, and my friend Sarah Guest said, "That sweater seems very Jeff Alessandrelli." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she was like, "It just seems like something that you would wear, and you're wearing it." But I've had it since eighth grade.
But so were you the size you are now in eighth grade?
I was a little chunkier in eighth grade, Sonny.
You were bigger than you are now
Yeah.
in eighth grade?
I mean, maybe it was big in eighth grade. I guess I'll take that back. But 10 years ago, I was bigger than I am now. I've lost weight over the years.
You look good.
Well, no. You
Yeah.
don't need to tell. I know that. Charles Val.
Yeah. So was this your first time interviewing without me in the room?
No.
Oh,
I'd interviewed Jason Merritt before.
I'm so unprepared. Well, this is your second.
Yes.
How'd it go?
I would give it an 84%. It went well. I had a little bit of issues with some of the, as you call them in radio parlance, dials.
The faders.
Right, whatever. I'm not part of the community.
No, we welcome you.
It went good. Once we got going, we really got going. We had a good chat.
So I might be revealing how little sleep I've been getting this week, but we've been talking for 2 minutes and I already can't remember if in that 2 minutes we said anything about Charles.
Well, Charles, so I met Charles 2 months ago, almost exactly, when him, me, and Gina Myers and her friend Lillian went to a Jawbreaker show. The band Jawbreaker played in downtown Portland, and they're a big band for me. So they reunited after like 15 years, maybe more, of not playing. And the show wasn't that great, to be honest. I mean, I was excited to see him, but before the show, we struck up a conversation. I didn't know that Charles Val lived in town, but he is one of the editors at Fence magazine, and Fence has always been one of my favorite magazines. Really, like when I was younger, it was one of the magazines that I really looked to for like, kind of like what's going on in contemporary poetry specifically, but also just writing generally. And he's been an editor there for 15 years, so we talk about that in the interview. So it was interesting to hear that. To hear that kind of, I guess, kind of history about a magazine that really mattered to me and matters to me. So yeah, he's in Portland. He's been here for a long time, and it was really good to kind of talk with him.
In addition to editing, does he write?
He does write. We didn't. Yeah, he does write. We talked about that. I don't think he has not published a book yet, but he certainly writes his own stuff as well. He's also really into music, as we get into. He's gone to hundreds of shows. We have. Yeah, we talk about some interesting stuff.
That's awesome. Well, let's listen.
Yeah.
Welcome to the steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like.
Good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this. Louder on the left. Okay, say something, will you?
Testes, testes.
Testes, testes. Good work. Are good. Where'd you go before this?
The slut.
What's the slut?
The sandy hut, the sandy butt, the sandy slut.
Is that really what it's?
We used to call it the slut, but I don't know what it's called now because there's a lot of new kids at the slut.
The Sandy Hut did not close. I think it had something happened.
I think it got like bought out by the folks who did the old Matador back in the day.
Right.
So I don't know who owns it now.
The Matador back in the day. I
You
had
know
some
what I'm
good
talking
notes.
about? Yes.
I mean, yeah, on the other side of the river.
That was an amazing urinal.
Oh, I know, right?
That was the best urinal in town.
Yeah,
It's
I know totally. There was two of them, right?
was like this massive thing, and you like kind of walked up to it and
So that's not there anymore. The Matador isn't there anymore?
Now it's gone, man.
Oh, really?
It's been gone for like I think 5 or 6 years.
Well, because I did you
Yeah.
ever go there after going to a show at the Crystal Ballroom?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So where are you from originally?
I was born in the Philippines and then kind of grew up in Southern California.
Grew up in Southern California, born in the Philippines, and then when'd you move to?
1980.
1900, when you moved to Southern California?
Yes.
Okay. Where in Southern California?
So kind of all over, but ended up in Orange County.
Oh, damn. The Orange Curtain?
Yes, the Orange Curtain. I was behind the Orange Curtain. Where'd we end up? Fuck. Buena Park, Yorba Linda, and then San Clemente. So we were kind of following Richard Nixon's footsteps.
Tricky, tricky.
Tricky dick?
Tricky dick.
Am I allowed to say that?
Well, because we're going on the radio. I don't know, technically, but I always forget to tell people at the beginning. so swearing, just keep your swears to a minimum. You can swear. I'm just going to put down the time code.
All right.
What did your parents do?
My parents were both nurses.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes. This is a big point of contention for my father, who felt that nursing was an effeminate industry. Huge deal for him.
But he did it his whole life, but he always felt kind of...
Yeah, emasculated.
And did that manifest itself in... being unhappy at home, kind of, or
yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, you got it.
He wasn't psyched on his profession.
He was not psyched on his profession.
And you knew that from what kind of a young age?
Yeah, I think like well, it was funny because I grew up in the Philippines without my father. My father was in the U.S. while I was in the Philippines.
Oh,
yeah. Until I was 7 years old, and then yeah.
So you moved there in 80, but until you were seven, you were there. Oh, okay. Now, do you have memories of that?
I do, man.
Have you been back? I mean, I assume since, right?
Yes. God.
1998. So that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I just realized how crazy long that's been.
That is a while. but did you remember anything?
I do. I do. I remember one of my vivid memories living under like the Marcos martial law was shopping for shoes, and my mom and I were shopping for shoes and they had to clear us out of the department store because Imelda Marcos was coming into the store, and we had to leave and vacate so she can shop like by herself.
Where in the Philippines did you live?
Yeah. Kind of the suburbs of Manila.
Suburbs of Manila. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a thing with the Beatles and Marcos too?
I think there was. I'm not quite sure. I heard like an NPR story like I think last month where they were talking about the Manila sound, which is the disco scene back in the 70s, which is apparently like kind of anti-Marcos sentiment going on there.
But under his rule.
Yeah.
Oh.
I need to learn more about that. I don't quite know the whole story, but it piqued my interest for sure.
So now you moved when you moved to California, Orange County, yeah. 1980. Now, did your parents listen to a lot of music, or was there a lot of like? What was your? Do you have siblings?
I do. I've got four sisters.
Oh, so big family. Okay.
Yeah. The only boy, four sisters.
Older, younger?
The second of five. So one older and then three younger.
Okay.
Three.
One older, three, yeah.
Ah, shit. Sorry. Yeah, I think as far as music, it was, you know, my dad was really into the Beatles.
Oh, really?
Which is pretty interesting because I hated the Beatles because of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think this is like some kind of deep-seated thing that I didn't really realize until like I was in my late 20s. Was like, oh, yeah, that's why I didn't like the Beatles because my dad really loved the Beatles.
And that wasn't something that you, I mean.
Yeah, it was almost like, okay, what else is there?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's somewhat natural, though, too. Yeah. I mean, to kind of rebel against.
For sure.
I don't like Sigmund Freud, but So now, is this in the Philippines, or is this is when you get to?
That's when I got to California. Yeah.
Okay, the Beatles are on, and you remember listening, like they were on when you were younger, and you would sometimes.
I'd be like, whatever. I mean, my dad was. There wasn't very much music playing from my parents, but you know, I think for me it was all about, you know, the radio.
Uh-huh.
And you know, California, Southern California in the '80s, you know. For me, it was like Rodney on the Rock. He was it. Rodney Bingenheimer.
Right. Did you see that documentary about him?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, well, neither have I, so we're good.
Okay. Yeah, I can't even remember what it's called.
I can't either. Yeah. Maybe it might be called Bingenheimer.
I might be.
He was in LA.
He was. Man, those Sunday night shows were just amazing. I don't know where you grew up, but like...
I grew up in Reno, Nevada.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So Sunday nights was Rodney time. You had to listen to Rodney.
What? So this is in the early 80s, and then what would he play? I mean, it would be like 2 hours?
I feel like it was longer than 2 hours. I can't remember how long the shows were, but they were pretty amazing.
Uh-huh.
Just so much good stuff. A lot of punk, a lot of garage stuff that just... didn't hear like a commercial radio rock at all.
Sure.
And, yeah, I think Orange County, you're kind of in between LA and San Diego. So it would be like K-Rock, mm-hmm. which is where Rodney was, or 91X was the San Diego station.
Okay.
And so those are the two big, the alternative, air quotes, radio stations, right?
Yeah, yeah. But this is not when you're, so this is when you're like in your early teens.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, for me, like, music was always, I think growing up, when I was really young, you know, I recall being very influenced by Kiss, because uh-huh. my older cousins were really into Kiss back in the, you know, when I was in late 70s. And then, early 80s, it was, like, just the stuff on K-Rock. Which is
like X, Germs, or stuff. I mean,
well, there, you know, for them, like the daily rotation was a lot of like alternative rock.
But this is before the term alternative rock was really. Yeah.
So it's a lot of new wave stuff.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
So
yeah.
a lot of new wave, but and then there was like Rodney, and he was like awesome, just so much awesome punk coming out of that stuff. And
yeah, I think of him as old. I mean, he played a lot of punk music.
He did, man. If you look at like his compilations, like I think there were three compilations. Yeah, check them out. They're like really awesome. The first one was like, you know, Agent Orange and stuff like that.
But he was, I mean, he would play like the Doors because he's older, right?
He's older.
So he's like a 60s.
He was.
Okay. So he changed with the times, though. I guess I didn't see, I know about him. I did not. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of like John Peel in that way.
Oh, I didn't. Well, because I think of John Peel as more influential than Rodney Bingenheimer.
For sure.
But.
Yes, for sure. But I think for like Southern California, they think like Rodney for sure was a. You know, for people, especially in Orange County, where you didn't really have that many venues, it was like, whoa, what is this guy playing?
You know?
It was kind of that kind of revelation for us.
Totally. Was your older sister into music? Did she turn you on to anything?
She was really into Duran Duran.
Duran Duran. Duran Duran's good.
Duran Duran's good. It's kind of funny because I remember every time we would fight, the only way I can get back at her was like defacing her Duran Duran posters in her room.
Oh.
And that just...
that must have been heavy. I mean, you would actually write on them?
I would. I think, John Taylor had a lot of mustaches.
John Taylor. God, yeah.
Everybody loved John Taylor.
Simon Le Bon.
Simon Le Bon
was the lead singer. John Taylor was keyboardist or guitarist?
He was the bassist.
But he was the heartthrob, right?
He was the heartthrob. I think it's like one of those... I can't think of another band where the bassist was like the heartthrob.
Paul McCartney and the Beatles.
Forgot about that.
But you're right. The bassist is normally not.
He's not the focal point of the teen.
Right. John Taylor, or is it John Tyler?
I think it's Taylor. John Taylor. Yeah, he was. People love that dude.
To this day.
To this day.
Duran Duran, do they still go on reunion tours? I mean, you probably don't know because you don't care, because who cares? But
you know, we had one of my daughter goes to this Montessori school, and I think what's it called? The administrator had brain cancer, and her like biggest wish was to meet Duran Duran.
A Make-A-Wish Foundation for Duran Duran, really?
And I think Duran, I think they did something where there was some intersect with Duran Duran.
Interesting. Yeah. This is recently?
Yeah, in the past 2 years.
And her biggest thing was to meet Duran Duran.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, I don't know what my Make-A-Wish Foundation wish would be, but I don't. That is wild, though, right?
That's a really good question to ask people.
What would yours be? Do you have any idea? I mean, if you were going to die and you had one wish, I mean, and hers was meet Duran Duran, I mean.
That is tough. I got to think about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's just wild, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
The power of John Taylor.
I guess, yeah. So what about writing and reading? I mean, is that something that's part of kind of your, is that around when you're younger? Your parents, writers, readers? I mean,
you know, they weren't.
They were not.
They really were not. You know, growing up, like, yeah, literature just wasn't a thing in our house.
Okay.
And I think that's why I embraced it, like, you know, as an adult was, this is this whole new territory for me.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting growing up in Orange County and, you know, when I recall when I was younger, they would, because I'm a person of color, they thought, oh, clearly you don't know English. And so we're going to put you in the, you know, kind of the lower levels of English.
This is in elementary or middle school?
This is more like middle school.
Okay.
Yeah, it was
just
really,
without talking to you?
It was really bizarre.
Okay, well, I'm sure, yeah, more than bizarre, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some kind of political agenda there for them. Maybe, perhaps, I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, no, it was, yeah, but yes, literature wasn't a big part of our growing up.
Uh-huh.
For sure. It was something I had to discover on my own.
And when was that, in high school, or when did you start?
I think it was mainly in college.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The funny thing was, you know, I really took to like science and math, and so they were like, "Oh, you're Asian, so you love science and math, right?" And it was like, "Okay, sure."
This is high school.
Is high school.
When you took to, I mean, you were naturally good at it, or you worked hard?
I was naturally good at math. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I guess there's some work there involved.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you worked hard, but also you had, it was somewhat, I mean.
Yes, it was easier for sure than English for me at first. Mm-hmm. In high school.
Sure.
Yeah, I think what's funny is when I was in undergrad, I went to UC Irvine, and and I was a physics and chemistry guy.
Oh.
And then but then I had to take some, you know, humanities courses, and there was this dude there, Jacques Derrida.
Oh god, really?
Yeah, and so I went to a couple of his lectures, and I'm like, what the F, like,
you can say, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and then I switched majors. I did. I switched to English after, I think, like my junior year. I switched from physics and chemistry to English. And,
because of Derrida, who was teaching at UC Irvine? This is really?
Yeah, it's a little bizarre. I think, you know, part of me was, I really didn't, you know, for like science and math came very easy for me, and so that was just the natural path.
And well, then, and you were probably pushed into it too, kind of, people.
Oh
yeah.
for sure yeah. So this goes back to my dad, right? So he didn't he wanted to be a doctor in the Philippines, and he didn't become a doctor. He had to, you know, bring in some coin, and so he became a nurse.
Uh-huh.
And went to the U.S. because that's how you made your money. You had to go to the U.S.
right?
And
that is why you guys came to the U.S.?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think back in the 60s, there was like a series of nurses strikes in the U.S. And the majority, that's why you've got so many of these like Filipina nurses coming over. Yeah. And because, you know, English was, you know, it was natural as far as the folks over there, and moving to the U.S., they kind of recruited this entire generation. So my dad was part of that. He was going to medical school at the time and ended up like, you know, going to New York as a nurse.
But this is because you moved to Orange County. This is before you, because you were back in the Philippines and he was in New York.
Correct. Okay. And then, so that was his whole thing, was like, oh, yeah, you got to be a doctor, because that's what I wanted to be.
Oh, so you were, was it explicitly said you're going to be a doctor?
Yes.
Oh, darn. So,
yeah. There was
a lot riding on, I mean. And so, you're the only son, you're the only male, right?
I am. And so when I quit the sciences and moved to humanities,
that was a big deal.
Yeah, there was, I think, 2 months where he didn't speak to me because of that.
Oh, gosh. And my dad actually went to Irvine. But going back a little bit, so did you start going to shows in high school? I mean, when did you start getting into music more? And I mean, was that you're rebelling against the Beatles? I mean,
yeah, I think for me, you know, listening to is a lot of music from the radio, obviously.
So we have Rodney Bingenheimer. Now, are your friends like, are they, did you like high school? We talk to people and everyone hates high school, and I didn't have that bad a high school experience, but.
I don't know if I hated high school. I think, you know, high school is just, it was an interesting time. I think everybody's kind of insane when they're in high school.
Yeah, right? I mean, super insecure and you're a tool, but I mean, some people had really bad experiences that we've, or at least one person that we talked to in here, but just generally, was it just high school? High school is high school. I mean,
I think, you know, I had a pretty, well, I think for me, music goes back a little bit to junior high, actually.
Okay.
Because I think back in junior high, I was, you know, listening to Rodney and a lot of the new wave stuff. I mean, I was really in a new order.
Like, oh, yeah.
And back then. And then, this kid moved into the neighborhood from D.C. and he like played this cassette tape of, you know, this band I'd never heard of called Minor Threat.
Ew.
And it was just like, what the fuck? Well, who are these guys? And it was amazing. So for me, that was kind of a really pivotal moment when because I think I was in seventh or eighth grade at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, okay, who else is on this label Discord? And so I really got into mail order.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I was really ordering a lot of cassettes from
in middle school.
In middle
school. So that is young. So I mean,
it was. I was really into a lot of 45s and cassettes. I remember in middle school at that point.
Well, you had your own tape player at the house?
I did. I had I had a paper route as a paper boy for a while, and that was like the first thing I bought with my own money. Was like this little console that had like two tape decks and a 45.
You were balling on that.
Oh yeah, it was a Yorks. I don't know if you recall Yorks.
Yorks.
It was a really piece of crap little console, but it worked. I mean, it had a turntable up top and two
wild
decks, so I could record stuff off the radio
on a bike. You listen to that on a bike or no?
No. I'm just saying I purchased it from my earnings.
I was gonna say. So why Minor Threat though? I mean, did you know about their whole DIY or
I didn't.
Just the music?
Just the music, because at that point, like, you know, I think the punk music that was being played over the radio didn't really resonate. You know, it was amazing music that I kind of loved and gravitated towards, but I didn't really understand like this whole community behind it, right?
What was being played over the radio?
Well,
Sex Pistols, or post that?
This is kind of mid 80s, and the stuff that Rodney was playing was, you know, like I said, a lot of Orange County punk at that point. So Social Distortion.
Oh, okay.
And Agent Orange, and I'm trying to think of who else was around at that time, but. Quite a, you know,
sure,
kind of that
like
orange.
Early NoFX or no, that was later. Okay,
a little bit later.
Okay, but Social Distortion, Agent Orange. Okay,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which was more produced than Minor Threat, or how would you do? How would you, I mean? How'd you differentiate? I guess them in your, because you were young, you know. Yeah, I mean, for some people, it's like, oh, it all sounds alike.
No,
I mean,
it's true, because I think that Minor Threat tape was just like this. It didn't feel as produced, right?
Well, no,
it's totally, I mean, not.
It's and not then, at all. Yeah.
Yeah, and then and there was just a rawness to it that was just like, mm-hmm. This isn't what's going on in California,
there's, right?
This isn't happening in California.
Well, the lyrics were very different too than Social Distortion, or I mean, totally.
For sure. I think, yes. Yeah, the whole out of step mindset was definitely seeping in, I think, by the time I was in high school. Just mm-hmm. like, what is going on? And in Southern California at that point, you know, and especially San Clemente, it was like, surfers and water polo dudes were like the kings of the campus.
Yeah. Which you were neither of those.
Yeah, I'm not. Although, you know, I surfed when I was like in junior high, and I'm just like, I'm not good at this, and I'm being totally ostracized by all these white dudes, and so I'm clearly not part of the scene.
But you did. Surfing's hard. Surfing. I mean, I grew up skateboarding, and sometimes, I didn't think it was going to be easy. I have friends who are just good at board sports.
Yeah.
And I'm frankly not one of them, but I did skateboard at kind of like a high level, but I've only done it on like five times, maybe six. Yeah. I could barely get up. I mean, but I guess it's different in Southern California. It's kind of...
Surfing's hard. It's hard. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to do well. Yeah. I mean, especially at that point, and you know, kids in junior high and high school are assholes.
Well, totally. I mean, that's totally true. So what else was on Discord? Do you remember what else you would get?
What else did I get at that point? I tried to figure out, the genealogy of, like, Ian MacKay. I'm just like, all right, there's Egg Hunt. Let me get this.
I don't know about Egg Hunt.
Egg Hunt was, like, I think it was his band before Minor Threat.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Dag Nasty was another.
I remember Dag Nasty.
Yeah, that was good.
They're good.
I'm trying to think of like what else. Nation of Ulysses kind of entered my world at that point, and it was just like, whoa, who's this dude?
Okay. Is this Rites of Spring? Were they on Discord?
They were. Rites of Spring was really good.
But this was that they were later.
They were, they're mid 80s.
Nation of Ulysses. I've never listened to them, but I know that name. What were they like?
So, that was Ian Svenonius from,
From the makeup.
Yeah,
really?
That was his band before.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, man, check out Nation of Ulysses. It's great stuff. Great stuff.
Have you ever met that dude?
Yes, I have. I've got a funny story about him.
You're going to have to tell it then.
All right, so.
Or, I mean, you don't have to tell it now, or I want to. He's an interesting guy. Now he's in that band called the Chain Gang. Chain and the Gang,
you follow him on Instagram?
No, I'm not on Instagram.
You're not on the Grams?
Social media depresses me. it does. Okay, but so Nation of Ulysses was Ian Savonius's pre-makeup band.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you're in early high school and you're getting into all this stuff.
I'm getting into all this stuff.
Are your friends too, though? Or I mean,
you know, the DC stuff didn't really seep into San Clemente.
So this is kind of you on your own island listening to this.
This is kind of me on my own island, and you know, there you would meet a couple like kindred souls and just be like, oh yeah, and then, but it wasn't like, it wasn't seeping in.
It wasn't. You go to a big high school?
I did, San Clemente High. I think there was like over 2,000 people.
So
there.
That's pretty big.
It's pretty big. So I graduated in the class of 91, which is a pretty interesting time in music, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, hip hop was just like.
Sure.
Well, what is this thing? And so people were, I guess the term New Jack was kind of being thrown around at that point.
Which was based off a movie? Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation. I mean, that came out in 90, I think, right?
It did. Did it?
90 or 91. Maybe right around there. I mean, there's a lot going on in music, yeah.
I recall like a lot of the West Coast stuff more as far as hip hop. Like Eazy-E was really big, and N.W.A. And then I think when I got into college, like Dre,
sure.
And
you went to Irvine.
I did. I went to Irvine, which is, you know, it's a commuter. Your dad went there?
My dad went there. My dad's a UC Irvine alum.
What year did he graduate?
He just turned 70, so I don't know. I mean,
so in the 60s, there's like...
Yeah, he probably graduated. He was born in 48, so he probably graduated in like 60, I don't know, maybe 1970, 60, right around there.
So you should ask him about the tunnels.
Okay, so no, I don't know anything about this.
All right, so like the big rumor was they created this tunnel system underneath UCI because they were afraid of all the student protests.
Oh.
Yeah, and so it was like this big like urban legend, like, oh, there are tunnels underneath UC Irvine so that the faculty can get away from the student protests.
Okay.
I don't know if that's real or not, but that was what was going around. And
when you were there, even that they would say that.
Yeah, in the 90s, they were talking about that. Like there was this underground like tunnel system.
Which to get away from student protests, because there was a lot of student protests at Irvine in the late 60s.
No, I think that's how like backwards and awful like Orange County is.
Oh, because I didn't know it was like a hotbed of student protests.
It wasn't.
So you go there for 2 years. What were you? What was your major?
So I ended up I started off chemistry and physics, and I ended up English. I got my
because English. Of Derrida too.
Yeah,
and it's not Jacques Derrida.
Jacques.
I know nothing about theory, okay. So
yeah.
I mean,
so the Critical Theory Institute is based in UCI. Yeah.
Okay. I guess
it is a big hotbed for critical theory.
Irvine is really interesting.
Yeah.
And so you took a couple classes on a whim.
It wasn't a whim. It was more like, yeah, you should check this guy out.
Because he was a big deal, obviously.
He was a big deal.
I mean, probably more so now, but I mean, this is...
You would there would be like people gathering and following him around. Like
oh.
He was some kind of like, you know, sage. And he was a sage. I mean, I went to a couple of his lectures and I'm just like, this guy just blew my... He blew my mind.
Blew your flipping mind.
Yeah.
Did he? So what are the most well-known Derrida books?
Say what?
What are the most well-known? I mean,
Of grammatology.
That was what I was gonna say. Okay,
yeah,
so that was it.
That's a big one. I mean, I don't know about like big or not. I mean, there's.
But you read this stuff, and it just blew your mind, kind of.
It kind of did. I mean,
it's tough stuff to kind of. I don't know. I mean, coming from, you're a physics major?
Yes.
I mean, that's...
So from the hard sciences to that, it was, it was a little bit of a change.
Right.
I mean that was the thing, it was a big change in perspective, right?
Right.
I mean, the fact is, I don't think I really, like, I had the facility and the capability for the hard sciences, but I never really embraced it. I was never really passionate about it,
mm-hmm.
right? I was really good in the lab. I'm very good at like the lab work, as I recall.
Right. Now you took classes from Derrida.
I took one class formally, but all his classes, you couldn't kind of just, they were this, everybody would just come. Like all the lectures were just filled.
And in a lecture hall? Like
yeah,
there's like 200 people there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You'd go in a lecture hall and there'd be like hundreds of people. People like in the aisles just like listening to this dude.
So that's like something out of a movie.
kind of.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he was a fascinating guy. He would just...
Was he out of the wheelchair? Did he commit suicide? Was that him? Do you know how...
I don't recall how he passed.
Okay.
No.
Maybe that was Foucault. I don't know. Okay.
I don't know.
So you take those classes though, and I mean, you're kind of you switch your major.
Yes.
And then, are you listening? What's your like during? I mean, are you reading a bunch of stuff? Are you listening to? I mean.
So at that point, I think like in the mid '90s, like you know, it was. The mid '90s were kind of a funny period. You know, I think I was listening to Pavement a lot.
Mm-hmm. Who were from Stockton, so I mean, relatively.
Yeah, yeah. I think the big thing for me was the Spinanes. Honestly,
okay.
They played on campus one day, and I was just like,
They played at the UC Irvine campus.
Yeah, and they played at this this mall in Orange County called The Lab. It was this this strip mall. They called it the Anti-Mall.
Okay. Did cool bands play there regularly? Okay, but the Spinanes did.
But the Spinanes did. And it was pretty funny because, you know, I at that point, like I think mid-90s, I was just listening to the, you know, I think Belle and Sebastian was kind of big at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Smith and Sleater-Kinney. And I'm just like, the Spinanes came out. I'm just like, I need to move to the Northwest, I feel like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so...
Because that show, do you remember that show? I mean, you saw that, was it well attended? I mean, it was...
No, I think there were like 20 people there.
Oh, well, like all great shows. I mean...
Well, yeah, I mean...
Were they bummed?
No, she didn't seem... Rebecca didn't seem that bummed.
Okay.
Yeah, I think... I'm trying to think, recall that period. You know, there was, I used to go to a lot of shows at that point, like quite a bit. And
in college at Irvine, people would come to the area.
Well, I mean, you'd end up going to, like, driving up to LA more than anything. There's a place called the Jabberjaw, which is a pretty.
Irvine to LA is how far?
About an hour.
Oh, so not far. Yeah. I always think of it as. My mom's from Fresno, and I always think of it as being...
No, it's not like that.
It's only an hour from LA. Okay.
Yeah. The Jabberjaw was a great venue, man. There were so many amazing bands that came out that played at the Jabberjaw.
Like who? You saw a lot of them?
Yeah. I'm just thinking of, like, all the bands in the mid-90s, and I think, you know, the majority of, I don't even know what you'd consider them, but indie, I guess, a bucket term, but yeah, they ended up at the Jabberjaw, and there's a pretty good compilation actually for shows at the Jabberjaw, and I'm trying to I don't recall the name of the compilation.
We'll find it. So are you writing at this point? I mean, are your friends your friend group, I assume, is into these things in a way that wasn't really the case when you were in Ireland, kind of in San Clemente?
For sure. And then I started writing poetry like at Irvine at that point. Irvine had a pretty, you know, they had an MFA program was pretty well established at that point, but I think they're more fiction.
Mm-hmm.
James McMichael was there for poetry. I'm trying to think who the other poets were, but yeah, okay. I ended up, you know, at that point I was working at Borders Books and Music.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love Borders. I remember. Yeah. I've had enjoyable times at Borders. Yeah.
Oh man. So yeah, I started working there, I think in 94, and I worked in the music section.
Oh.
So that.
Okay. So who are you reading at this point? Do you remember? I mean, you're taking classes from Derrida. You're influenced by kind of theory.
Yeah. It's more theory than poetry at that point.
Oh.
That was the fascinating part, was I really didn't, it definitely was more theory than poetry in the undergrad days there.
But you started writing poetry.
I did.
Okay.
And so, you know, around that point, I really started thinking, you know, as I think I discovered like Ashbery around 96, 97.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just like, whoa, who's this guy?
And are you discovering through friends? Like, are your friends writers too at that point, or how do you remember?
It was mainly like coworkers, honestly. Like
at Borders?
Coworkers at Borders. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Did you ever see Tower Records?
Yeah.
I mean, Borders was the corporate tower, maybe. Well, no, it was called Empire Records, wasn't it?
That Empire movie Records,
with
yeah.
Liv Tyler.
You're talking about the movie, yes.
I'm talking about the movie. Tower Records was cool, but yeah.
There was a Tower Records, and my friend had a couple friends who were working there.
I used to spend hours in Tower Records just looking at the magazines.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Borders, too, though. There was a Borders near where I lived. I mean, Borders was great. I mean, yeah.
They were ubiquitous. But yeah, like Tower was like definitely on the cooler level.
I mean, still. So you graduated in 91, you said?
I graduated high school in 91. I graduated from Irvine, I think, 96.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in English, or what was your...
In English. I graduated English, 96. And then just kind of fucked off.
Did you stay in California or what?
So this is a funny story. Like, I remember like 2 months before graduation, they had a career fair. And it's this big convention hall. And it was like sciences and, you know. And there was this tiny row for like the humanities graduates.
Uh-huh.
And it was like... the CIA, the FBI.
Oh, really?
Teaching English in Japan.
Right.
And Mammoth Lakes ski resort.
Okay.
So
that was for the humanities.
That was the humanities. There were like I think like four or five booths.
That and the one the CIA, the FBI. That's awesome.
And yeah, of course, I ended up becoming a ski lift operator at Mammoth Lakes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is Mammoth in Northern California. That Mammoth. Okay. Yes. Well, being from Northern Nevada, I know
close,
Mammoth.
Close to you, man.
So you were a ski lift operator there?
I was a lifty. Yeah.
For how long?
So for a season, I'm just like, okay, this is great. I'm going to go write my great American novel and become a, you know, and snowboard.
Sure, which is, I mean, that makes sense, though, too. You take some time off. Now, were your parents bummed? Or what was your
relationship? Oh, yeah, they were totally bummed. They were just like, what are they doing? What are you doing with your life?
Well, yeah.
You should have been a doctor. Now you're a ski lift operator. That's, you know.
But you're still in contact with them.
Yes, they
But it wasn't, they were just bummed.
They were just bummed.
Well, no, I mean, so, what's your older sister do? Or, I mean, what were you kind of up against in terms of?
So she went to, I think she went to UC Santa Barbara. And oh, then, okay. So she was.
My sister went to UC Santa Barbara. So, oh, really? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that Isla Vista. I mean, which is funny considering, like, think of the whole Brett Kavanaugh thing right now. Holy, what the hell was going on there? That you don't even, I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, that's another.
That's stuff you don't want to unpack, right?
Like, right, that's another show that, yeah. I mean, but yes.
Yeah, so she went to UC Santa Barbara and I went to Mammoth Lakes.
But was she overachiever? Was she kind of like an overachiever?
She wasn't. So,
it wasn't.
I got some slack. I got some slack.
So you go there to write a novel though, kind of, to be,
Yeah, so, And then I wanted to write a novel, and I think I got a couple chapters in, and then it just didn't happen. I mean, you just get caught up in the social scene up there, and it's kind of awful.
Well, also, you're 22 and 23, right?
I think I was 22 at the time, 21, 22.
Do you have the novel, or do you remember what it's about? Or you must have. Did you keep it?
There might be a copy around, but probably not.
It wasn't something.
The writing back then was just kind of awful.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll call it marginalia at this point.
All right. I mean, I'm not dogging on you. I was simply curious. So you do that for a while, and then how do you make your way to New York eventually?
So that's a funny story. Like, I think this was 96, and, you know, my best friend called me at the time, and he was living in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, what are you doing? And I'm just like, I'm getting drunk every night, and that's about it. He's just like, well, come out to Kentucky. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go out to Kentucky.
You'd been in Mammoth for a year at this point, or you've been there for a while?
About like 7 months, I think.
So
yeah, and then I packed up the car and drove to Kentucky.
Who you met, you knew him or her or they from college?
I knew him from high school, and then ended up in Kentucky. So
where in Kentucky?
Lexington.
Oh.
You've been to Lexington, Kentucky?
I haven't, but that's the capital of Kentucky, isn't it? Lexington, Kentucky. Yeah, I'm almost positive. Is it not?
It's in the middle. I don't know if it's the actual capital.
Okay, well, I've heard of what. Tell me about Lexington, Kentucky. I've heard of it.
It's not as cool as Louisville.
Okay, maybe Louisville. Well, anyways, yes. Okay. So you, so you.
So it's not Louisville, by the way. It's Louisville.
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 Say it again.
Louisville.
Louisville.
Yeah. They
is that a big thing?
That is.
Well, that's just like being from Nevada when people say Nevada.
Oh yeah.
I hate it. I mean, and now people do it because. It's just to irk me, but
it's so like Oregon and Oregon, yeah, same kind of thing.
So you move out there kind of because he's out there. So you have a friend.
My best friend's out there, and it was just like I just need time to figure out what the hell I'm doing.
What was he doing out there? Did he have a job for you or anything or no?
Nah, he was just going to school out there.
Okay,
and then he ended up like I don't know what he ended up like meeting this girl and. ended up getting married. And so I was just out there in Kentucky not knowing what the hell I was doing. It was fascinating, man. I ended up like...
Well, from California to Kentucky, it must have been...
It was a huge shock.
I was going to say,
completely.
Yeah.
Like, people... I still have my California license plates on my car, and people would be like, what are you doing out here? And
right.
Like, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing out here, guys. Yeah. I ended up at Lexmark. Remember the printers, Lexmark?
Yeah, okay.
So I ended up as a line operator at Lexmark, putting chips into boards.
Okay, you have your BA in English.
Yes.
Okay, you'd been in Mammoth for 7 months, and now...
And now I am going...
Are you meeting people? I mean, what's going on socially? Yeah,
socially, I'm like, my friend Shane was out there and, like, you know, got absorbed into his social circle, and then there was Louisville.
Okay.
And there was Cincinnati. So there were really good shows going on in the mid-90s.
Because Lexington to Cincinnati and Louisville is...
So I think they're all within an hour away from Lexington. So yeah, I remember seeing a lot of shows in Cincinnati and in Lexington. I mean, there's...
Like Guided by Voices? Or what? Do you remember who?
Ooh, I think I saw Guided by Voices before then, but I recall seeing them... I don't think I actually saw them in Cincinnati.
They're from Ohio.
Yeah, they are. They're kind of northern. I saw, there's that whole triangle, right? Chicago, Louisville, Chapel Hill,
mm-hmm.
the triangle. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of those bands just kind of came through and saw quite a few of those shows in Louisville and Cincinnati.
So you'd be someone, though, who would drive to go see a show. I mean, you're into music. Like, it wasn't...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was probably going to at least 2 or 3 shows a week at that point.
Still. Oh, and you're working at Lexmark, too. So, okay.
Can I tell you a funny story?
Yes.
I think I've got, I have quit 19 jobs in my life.
Gosh, that's like, quite a few.
Just, like, walked out. So...
Literally, you didn't tell, you just walked out?
Yeah, so when I was at Lexmark, I said, and my boss at the time, his name was Larry Shoemaker, and his name was Shu, and I'm like, hey, Shu, I gotta go to the bathroom. And he's like, okay, because you gotta tell him when you're going to the bathroom.
Uh-huh.
Like, you're a goddamn slave. Uh-huh. So you've got these, like, grounding things on your feet so you don't, like, you know, short-circuit the boards at Lexmark. And I recall, like, specifically, like, sitting there on the line and just ripping off the grounding things and just walking to the bathroom and just going to my car and never coming back.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you did – how long were you there for?
I was there for, like, 3 or 4 months. Awful job.
Hated it?
I've had a lot of awful jobs.
But that one sounds – you had grounding things on your shoes?
Yeah, because you can't, like, you don't want to short-circuit the boards.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Bizarre.
So then, and now, are you writing poems then at this point?
I am.
Was Shane a poet?
Shane was a poet, but he never really did anything with it. He just kind of.
But he shared your interest, I guess. I mean,
we did share interests, and then, I met a couple of his friends who were also poets, and so, yeah, that's the funny thing about the poetry scene. There's like. This entire other world of like poets who just don't submit or do anything with their poetry other than share with their friends, right?
And they're the best poets normally because they don't. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating, right? They're not tainted by the industry, and
they're pure in some ways, and I mean sometimes there's a lot of ambition for what in the end is kind of silly, but
for
I mean,
sure.
But yeah, no, I mean, so he would write, but he would write kind of
yeah.
And then did you start trying to publish? I mean, is this when you were like, well, I want to...
I didn't start publishing until, I think it was 99, 2000.
But honestly. You were thinking about it then, or you were more serious. It's more of a serious writer than...
Yeah. I mean, poetry's kind of funny, right? I mean, what is a serious poet? Other,
Well, I just meant somebody who's trying to publish, I guess. I mean, is that you're right. It doesn't necessarily mean you're serious, but...
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think at that point, I didn't know any published authors or, published poets.
And this is in Lexington.
Yeah, this was in Lexington. And then, after I quit Lexmark, I ended up, I ended up staying there for another month. I worked at, a coffee shop and a bar. And then I'm just I should probably just go back to California.
So how long were you there for?
In Lexington, like 8 months, I think.
So not even a full year.
Not even a full year. I couldn't hang, man.
Okay.
I tried. I couldn't hang. And yeah, I ended up back in California.
But you saw a bunch of shows. I mean, you were writing. I did. Okay.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Like the shows over in the Midwest, like, you know, the definitely a different community than, like, you know, folks in California for sure.
How so?
You know, they seemed a bit more tight, you know, as far as like everybody knowing each other in the scene, which you saw like in different pockets, I feel like in California, but not that tight. I mean, it was just, you know, everybody knew each other.
But I mean, these are shows that you're going to, mostly indie shows, kind of. I mean, so yeah. People kind of stick with one another because they don't have a huge community.
For sure.
I mean, okay. Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, you think of like kind of the indie shows that come through in like the larger metro areas, and there isn't that community, right?
Right. I mean,
New York, LA. I mean, it's just like, you know, you may see some people that you've seen in other shows, but there isn't that community. Like, oh, you know, let's go hang.
Well, right. You might see them, but you don't necessarily acknowledge that you know them or that you saw them two days ago.
Yeah, I think that's like when I went back to California, I really did get into a lot of the Northwest bands at that point. That's kind of what, you know, for me, the Spinanes and Sleater-Kinney and Elliott Smith were just like what drove me to Portland at that point.
Okay.
So, yeah, I moved to Portland in 98.
You moved to Portland in 98. So you move from Lexington, you go back to California for a bit, and then you end up in Portland.
Yeah.
And this is when did Dig Me Out? So, I mean, a lot of stuff is happening
There's
here.
A lot going on. I mean, Portland in 98 was pretty awesome.
What was happening here in 98? I mean, 20 years ago, which isn't that long in the scheme of things, but it was a different town. But you tell me. I moved here originally in 05. Like,
completely. I remember, like, you know, the shows at EJ's and Satyricon.
Okay. Where was EJ's?
I think it's where B was now. Like,
okay.
That area.
Yeah.
And,
Satyricon was downtown.
It was. Yeah. Which, is it still around? I'm not quite sure.
No, I don't think it's around anymore.
Former iteration. You know, I think my friend Lawrence from Brooklyn moved out here a few years ago, and he's, you know, we're talking about like the appreciation for history in New York versus the appreciation for history here in Portland. It's, you know, it's interesting, right? I feel like there's so much change here in Portland where, you know, there isn't that appreciation for specific sites, right? Like there is over there.
There is not in Portland.
It's not. I remember, like, you know, I think of like different like house shows and like different bars and different venues back then. And it's like, I don't know where the hell they are now.
In Portland.
In Portland. I don't know. There was a bar called the Jockey Club back in the 90s. I have no idea where. I know it's somewhere on Killingsworth.
But it had amazing things. It had amazing shows. I mean, yeah, places in New York are revered. I mean, obviously there's CBGBs, but there's smaller places too that people are
tons
like.
Of
and
places.
Now you think it's not the same kind of.
Completely.
Huh.
Completely.
Why?
I don't know.
Just because there's so much. Why do you think that is?
You know, we were trying to discuss this. Like, I you know, for me, part of it is just like. Like history for people in Portland, it's more like lived experiences versus some kind of like revered collective experience. I don't know if I'm just tossing this out as just like
lived experience versus what?
Versus like a collective experience, right? Like, you know, if you talk to a lot of people who were born and raised in Portland, it's like, you know, you talk about their cultural markers. It's like these TV shows or, you know, something that they recall fondly as a youth. But it's never just like the same way as people talk about, you know, site specificity in New York, right?
Huh.
And I don't know if that's, I don't know why that is.
That's interesting. I mean, I've never lived in New York though either. I mean, I've just kind of seen it from afar, but I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't disagree with you, though. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I mean,
there isn't that, like, you know, people don't hold on to things in that sense here, right?
Hmm.
I mean, things get, you know, buildings get raised all the time, and it's just like, oh, yeah, it's another condo building.
But that happens more in New York, right? But you think there's more reverence for what was here? Maybe that's an East Coast history thing, kind of.
I don't know. I don't know if that's a East Coast, West Coast thing.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's not. It's definitely not like that in California, right? I mean.
Sure. No, yeah.
I mean, they don't care.
Right.
They raise and build over there. But yeah, it's a kind of funny thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I moved here in like 98, I remember like just the community here was so tight. I mean,
was it hard for you to break into that, or what? You moved here. Had you been here before?
No, I visited my friend Shelly, who was also at Borders, moved up here.
Oh, you're still working at Borders?
I was.
Oh, man. Cool. You could kind of move. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So I moved from like the Borders down in California to the Borders up here.
Was it the one in Lloyd Center?
Which one? No, the one in Beaverton.
Oh.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
Okay. So you, yeah.
Which is funny because that's where I met my wife, was Beaverton, Oregon.
Oh, nice. At Borders?
At Borders.
Yeah. Oh, awesome.
It's kind of funny, man.
That's great. Yeah. I mean.
But yeah, it was I thought it was, you know, the LA is really hard to penetrate. Okay. As far as the social scene. I mean, it really is. I feel like it's harder to penetrate there than almost anywhere else in the country, really, because it's really easy to penetrate in New York, and it was really easy for me to penetrate here in that sense of just like I came in and people were very embracing of just like, oh, you've got similar aesthetics and we love what you bring to the community, and
sure,
come on in and enjoy this.
Right.
Whereas in LA, it's just like, oh, what do you have? What do you...
Well, yeah. Well, LA is always spread out too, right? I mean, everyone has their little kind of cliques.
For sure, for sure. But yeah, I thought moving up here was, you know, just an amazing experience for me in my early 20s. You know, people were just like, really, like I said, they kind of were so inclusive compared to most other social scenes I'd experienced before. And, you know, there were so many awesome house shows.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm old now, so I don't know if, like, what the house
shows. No, well, I mean, tell me about what, like, anything that's, well, yeah, what sticks out to you?
You know, Matt, this dude Kurt and Mark from Magic Marker Records.
Okay, so I don't know anything about, yeah.
Yeah, so back in like the late 90s, they had a record label called Magic Marker Records. And,
okay.
And they lived together, and so there's the Magic Marker House. And so they'd have all these awesome shows at their house. And it was,
where was the Magic Marker House?
Yeah, somewhere in Southeast. I'm trying to think. I have no idea. Somewhere in Southeast.
Somewhere in Southeast. Okay.
Maybe like
inner Southeast though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it'd be like, hey, the Softies are playing at our house. Cool. Oh. Let's go over to the Magic Marker House. You know, just I'm trying to think of like all the great shows they had there, but they had quite a few, and they were, you know, so many awesome people who were just like, you know, be so open to to people coming in. You know, back then there was a venue called 17 Nautical Miles.
Okay.
Which is, you know, they were right by the Lutz Tavern.
Okay, well, I know the Soas is on Woodstock.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that had so many amazing shows as well.
17
Nautical Miles.
That was a venue.
That was a venue.
Where was it? Where it was just right next to like where the Delta is, kind of?
Yeah, right next door to the Delta.
Okay.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, they had so many great shows there. So it was a lot of like the K Records folks coming down. A lot of those shows came over there.
Now, did you know these musicians? I mean, were people like, there's Charles, or like, were you... What was your social group like? I mean, writers, musicians, was it?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. You know, I'm kind of I don't really straddle into, I straddle a lot of different worlds in that way. So yeah,
I mean, between
the writers and the musicians and all the other folks, it was just, a little bit of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think throughout my life, I've always been kind of the person trying to connect different worlds together just to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of why I was really drawn to Fence, was just like, there are no stakes in the ground here. Let's just see what happens when we try to get everybody together.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were in Portland for how long before you did
MFA
and what have you?
So I was in Portland from 98 to 2001.
A while. I mean, especially in your early 20s, that's like 100 years.
It is. Yeah. It's like 10 lifetimes, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, seriously, you know, I mean.
Yeah, so I think like 2001, I'm just like, I'm kind of sick of doing retail. So
you were still at Borders that whole, you were at Borders that whole time?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So you were, okay. Yeah, so then that's also when you're like, am I going to be a lifer at Borders or am I going to do something else? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, do you want to be a general manager or do you want to do something?
Oh, so you were moving up the ranks and you were nervous almost.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was like an assistant manager of the music department there and it was just like, okay. Here's my career path, or I can do something that I'm like passionate about.
Because so, you're writing this whole time, or what's going on with
that?
I was.
I was writing the whole time, and then I ended up, you know, thinking about an MFA, and I ended up at Notre Dame in 2001. Oh. So,
did you apply to a bunch of places?
I did. I applied to like, well, not a bunch. I think like five different places.
Is that a bunch? I don't think so.
Okay.
But I think now people apply to like 25.
Holy shit, is that for real?
I mean, I've been told... I think so. I think you apply to a lot and whatever your funding is, I mean, you go to the place with the best funding. I mean, I only got an MA and then I got a PhD, but I applied to three places for my MA and I got into, no, I applied to four. I got into two of them. Yeah. And then I applied to six the next go around.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I applied to five, I think. And then, I got into like, I got into three.
Oh, so you were good.
And then, nah, I mean, I don't know what that means.
Well, three out of five, I mean.
And then, yeah, Notre Dame.
Okay.
They had the money.
And
they,
so.
They did. It was like, and then there was this dude there, John Mathias. I don't know if you're familiar.
A little bit. Okay.
He's part of the Stanford Five.
The Stanford, what's the Stanford Five?
It's like basically the folks underneath Ivor Winters.
Okay.
So James McMichael, John Mathias, God, there's so many. I can't remember the three. But
Ivor Winters was known as, was that a new critic?
Yeah. What
was, he was known as a critic, right? Or am I wrong?
He was. He's more well known for his criticism than his poetry.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was 2001, and then...
Did you know who this guy was before you went, or they just offered the best funding?
Well, no, I knew who he was.
Oh, so you did know his...
I did know who John Mathias was. And he's a fascinating poet, man.
Oh, really? I should check him out.
Check him out, man. He's an interesting guy. And they offered the most...
Well, no.
That sounds awful, but,
I think that's the way it is. I mean, I don't, you know... Sounds awful, but it's honest. I mean, I think to take out huge loans to get a Master of Fine Arts degree that in the scheme of things doesn't really make you a master of anything is, I think, silly. But I mean,
yes.
So you went, had you ever, when Notre Dame's
in South Bend, Indiana.
Okay, Notre Dame's in Indiana.
So
okay.
I went back to the Midwest.
Are you married to your wife at this point? Or
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not. Man, Indiana was just like, where am I?
Because you went from Southern California to, I guess you went to Lexington, but then Portland, and then, yeah that must have been different. In the early aughts,
Yeah, so I got there in August of 2001. And,
God, right before, okay.
Yeah. It was pretty interesting because I don't know if you know, do you know Jenny Booley?
I don't know her, but I know her name. Yeah. Yeah, I know some of her work. Yeah.
So she was over there at that point and
as a student.
Yeah. She was a student at that point. And then, and then 9/11 happened. It was just like, what the hell's going on?
But you had no New York ties. I guess your dad used to live there, but you didn't.
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't have any New York ties. There's this guy, Steve Tomasula. He's a fiction writer who writes some really interesting work. And he taught a class on small press publishing,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I learned about Fence. And
because you read a bunch of journals, and the only ones that stuck out were Fence, Sulphur, and McSweeney's. I've done my homework.
Yeah, there's some bad journals you put in that mix.
So you were a first year? Was it a 2-year program or three?
It was a 2-year program. 2 years. And so between my first and second year, I emailed Rebecca and was just like,
mm-hmm.
You looking for interns? And she...
Just out of the blue, kind of.
Just out of the blue.
Were you learning a lot in Indiana? I mean, do you remember what you were reading or, I guess, listening to?
Yeah, I mean, as far as what I was reading, just opening my mind to like lots of different aesthetics that I wasn't really seeking at that point. So it's pretty interesting. As far as the music was, you know, early 2000s was a weird period in music, right? I mean, there was...
I mean, it was post like Papa Roach and Limp Bizkit. Yeah, I mean, it was just getting over that, yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, 2000, 2001, you know, the Strokes had kind of just opened things up to like this whole other like trajectory. You know, I'm trying to think who else.
Interpol, I mean, at that point. White Stripes. I mean, I guess, yeah. I guess they came after, you're going to say.
Yeah.
So a lot of New York bands, you're in Indiana and you're emailing someone about an internship in New York. I mean, it wasn't because of music, but I mean, was it enticing too?
It was enticing at that point, for sure. Yeah, I think it was mainly about Fence, but yeah, the music was and you know, I think for me I'd always wanted to, you know, live in New York.
Oh, really? So that always been kind of like being from the West Coast, I have no interest in moving to New York.
Really?
Because it's also too my dad's side of the family. My dad's from San Francisco. My sister used to live there, my cousins live there. I mean, and it's very congested and I love San Francisco, but I don't have any interest, I guess. And I mean, yeah, I don't know is the answer to your question. But that was always something that, I mean, there's a lot happening in New York. I'll give you that.
It's interesting, like the physical constraint you're kind of talking about versus I think for me, it was almost like this liberating feeling. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, New York is like such a liberating city. Right?
Yeah.
You can just be, and nobody cares about what you really like or, you know, what community you're part of. You're just in with millions of other people.
Sure.
And that's a liberating feeling.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, you were in Indiana at the time, too, which I assume was not totally like that.
No, I mean, I felt very much like... You know, I would talk about music in Indiana, and they'd be like, I don't know who the hell you're talking about. And I was, you know, that was... I think for me, the period in South Bend, I was over in, you know, I think every weekend I'd be in Chicago, just like going to bands, going to see shows. Like literally every weekend I'd be driving to Chicago and seeing.
How far is it from South Bend to Chicago?
About an hour and a half. Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Did you have friends in that program though?
Yeah, I mean, well, I made friends. I didn't know anybody going in there. I hadn't, you know.
Sure.
I knew nobody walking into that program, which is...
But you would go to shows with... I mean, you wouldn't go to shows alone, or would you? Depends.
No, I think I would just recruit people to just be like, hey, here's this band you've never heard of. Let's go see the show. And
so this is... I mean, who's in, like... I always think of, like, Wilco, or, like, I mean, who would you go... Do you remember anything?
It's mainly, like, bands who are traveling. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I saw Wilco once or twice when I was out there. This is early 2000s, so I think I was still into a lot of the indie pop stuff. I'm trying to think of who the most memorable shows were at that point. But
was there some venue, something with a bottle in it?
Like, oh yeah, the Empty Bottle.
Yeah,
that place was great, man.
I don't think I've ever been there, but I've heard about it.
Oh yeah, there were a couple good shows that came out of there that we saw over there. I'm trying to think of the other ones. We once saw, like, we went to a house show in Chicago once, in South Chicago. Pretty funny story. You're, like, driving over there, and there was, like, you know, like, the metal, like, barrels with fire and a bunch of, you know, it seemed like some old, like, is this really happening?
Right.
And people would be like...
I don't think I've ever seen that in real life.
Frankly. Yeah, and I had never seen that. Actually, I can't say that. I saw that in real life in Baltimore once, but and then in Chicago we saw it a couple times, and it was just like, oh, this is really happening.
Right.
This
is... Yeah, no, I don't. Okay.
I think one time we were trying to go see The Makeup of All Bands over in Chicago, and I remember this. We were lost and trying to figure out the map, and this guy like tapped on the window. It was just like, you guys don't belong here.
Oh, really?
You guys need to get out of here right now. And I'm just like, okay, we're getting out of here.
Was it night?
Yeah, this is a night in South Chicago.
And was he like warning you, or was he going to punk you himself?
No, he was like warning us, like, you guys shouldn't be here.
Oh, did you get out of there?
Yeah, we got out.
I mean, I would have broke out too. So, okay, but so you do graduate.
I do graduate. I graduated and I had my internship between my first and second year, and then when I graduated.
Oh, so you went out there that summer. Oh,
I did.
Okay. So
and then Rebecca was just like, "Hey, the managing editor is leaving. Do you want to be managing editor of Fence?" And I'm like, "Sweet, I'll take it."
And did you, I mean, you didn't know her when you emailed her. Did you vibe well immediately? I mean, is it kind of
when I first met Rebecca, I was like 30 minutes late, and I'm just like, oh my God, she's not going to deal with me at all.
Right.
But, we're both, I don't know. We both have this connection that's not really intimate, but at the same time, it feels very natural. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to explain it other than we just
symbiotic in some way.
I don't know what she gets out of me, but, but yeah.
But you work well together is the way I'm in is the most. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we get along very well in that sense.
So you moved there in 2003?
I did.
So there's a lot. I mean, that's okay. So that's an interesting time to. I mean, there was a lot happening in New York at that time, musically. I'm sure.
Musically and
literary. How do you say literarily?
Literarily.
Yeah. Well, I can't say some of those words, but
yeah.
And then you see you're the managing editor and managing editor of Fence.
I was,
which
yeah.
is, I mean, was were you kind of ecstatic or I mean?
I mean, I was. It was interesting because you know I moved there and like had zero. You know, I ended up selling like a lot of my records just to make it out there. And I think I sold all my CDs at that point too.
Yeah.
And.
When they were actually worth money back in the day, because now they're, yeah. Well, they're not. I mean, CDs are worth nothing now.
I don't even know how much you can get for a CD now.
You can get nothing.
Really?
I mean, to buy one, we could buy CDs right now, but if I was going to sell you, I mean,
not even a dollar?
Like, I'm sure you can get a dollar, but I mean, CDs are, they used to cost $18.99, you know what I mean? Like,
It's true.
Now, if you sold them on, I mean, maybe you can get a dollar and then you charge shipping, but I mean, CDs is a thing, yeah.
All right, so I think I sold high.
You got smart.
I think I sold like 2,000 CDs.
Gosh,
and I'm
so
just,
you got rid of a lot, though. That's a
I
lot
did,
of liquidation.
Man, I sold a lot of CDs. I sold all my CDs. I kept like probably half my record. I sold half of the... I sold all expensive records, and then...
But you were going to shows, but you had your own stuff, too, obviously. I mean, you went to a lot of shows, but you also bought a lot of music that you physically own.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's to this day, it's been, like, this source of frustration for my wife. Just, like, why are we...
Okay.
Why are we bringing all these records? Because, like, you know...
Well, I'm a pack rat, so I keep everything, which is not always... I think I've gotten better, but yeah, I keep a lot of stuff. I mean, have you gotten better as you've gotten older? I guess you got rid of all that stuff. I mean,
I think like okay, so I'm trying to think about this. Like, I think the peak of my like vinyl collection was probably like before grad school. Like,
oh,
I probably had like you know 2,000 or 3,000 records. So I think like what we brought to New York was, you know, probably 1,000 records.
That's
so
still a lot of records,
it's
though.
It's a lot to haul, man.
I just moved 2 months ago. I mean, yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. Like, do you have more records or books?
I have more books.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, that's I have a lot of records. 1,000 records is a lot. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, but they're like, they're dudes with like big collections.
No,
here.
I know. But I mean, especially moving, you always think like this is taking up a lot of space. And I haven't listened to this in 2 years and I haven't read this in 20 years. Or, I mean, that's what I just moved. So.
Yeah.
So you got rid of all that stuff. You made some money.
I did. And that's how we survived. Because, you know, I think I, you know, Rebecca was like, you can be managing editor, but you're, you know, here's your salary, $500 a month.
Which is not much.
And so it was pretty rough going there for a little while. And it was fine. I mean, like.
Did you know anyone in New York other than her?
My wife's best friend was living in New York at the time, and then,
okay, and you were together at that point.
We were
okay, and, so you were going with someone, so you had a little
yeah. And man, New York's so easy to meet people.
Is it? Okay.
It's like I don't, you know, I'm not the most social person.
Well,
but man, it's so easy to meet people there.
Yeah, people share similar interests, though.
For sure. I mean. I think, you know, within a year, like, our social circle grew to like over 100 pretty quickly. Oh. And it was just like, okay.
Through the magazine or just through music or everything?
Through everything.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I think I'm always the kind of person who's straddling different worlds. And so it was always interesting kind of colliding them and see what would happen.
Right. Did you ever play music yourself? What I was wanted to ask at the beginning, but
yeah. I took some courses. I played some I did a lot of classical guitar study.
Yeah,
probably not a lot, but 4 years worth. And
that's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would. There were a couple coffee shops where I played classical guitar.
There's nothing. Okay.
It's kind of embarrassing.
What's embarrassing about that?
I don't know. It is.
So, but do you still play? You play guitar?
I do not play guitar. It's hard for me to say that I play guitar because I don't play it very proficiently. I don't play it creatively.
But you can play chords.
I can play chords. I can't read music anymore, man.
But then you used to be able to do all these things.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that's just fascinating for me. It's just how you lose language, right? I can't read music anymore. And I used to be able to read music.
Well, I mean, so did I when I was younger. I mean, yeah. I just, you don't, I mean, how did you lose it? You just didn't keep up with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I was born in the Philippines. My native language is Tagalog,
mm-hmm.
and I can't speak it anymore.
Right.
But I can hear it. Well, I can hear music and I can see it interpreted in my mind, but I can't articulate it. And that's one of those weird, frustrating things, right?
Sure. But yeah. I mean, when you can, so you can understand it's, I know how you spell, but how do you say Tagalog?
Tagalog. T-A-G-A-L-O-G.
Yeah. So you can understand it if I was speaking.
Oh, yeah. My mom speaks to me in Tagalog and I'll just answer in English.
Oh.
But
you yourself cannot speak.
I have to think about it.
Right. Well, that's not. But I mean, then you can articulate. It just takes you a little bit of time.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, you're just speaking English just to be
right
expedient.
But with music too, I mean, you used to be able to read music proficiently.
Yeah.
And
I can now.
But you didn't. But you also didn't keep it up.
Yeah. And that is.
If you started tomorrow, I'm going to take an hour every day, you could probably get it fairly quickly.
I would hope so. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Part of me is just I'm getting old and I'm just
I think, man, that's all. That's not true.
You know? See, this is it's one of those wishful thinking things, Jeff.
Well, that's what I think, yeah. So you're in New York for how long? I mean, you're in New York, I guess, how long were you in New York for?
So we were in New York from, I think, 2003. This is the funny thing is, when we moved there in 2003, we were living in Rebecca's apartment because she ended up moving upstate. And so she's just like, listen, you can sublet my apartment. This is over in Greenwich Village. And then one day we get there and there's all these eviction notices tacked on. And I'm not talking just one or two. It's literally the entire door was stapled with the eviction notices. And we're just like, oh, shit, this is done. We're done.
That's heavy.
We're done here. And then we ended up, another fence editor at that time, Carolyn Krumpacker. She had an apartment over in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. And so she's just like, listen, you can sublet my apartment. And then, we ended up moving from Manhattan to Brooklyn. And we stayed in that apartment for a good 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was pretty interesting.
And was editing an issue of Fence like that back in the day, was it a very collective thing? I mean.
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. I mean, at that point, mid-2000s. You know, everybody's kind of mid-career at that point. There are folks who are ready to yeah, there's
the Suicide Girl issue of Fence that I stole from Portland State Library.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, this was an important issue for me. I mean, you were the editor at home, design editor.
Yeah, that was a interesting issue. At that point in Fence, I mean, so Rebecca was upstate at that point, and, her involvement was just, kind of, she was more heavily invested in the books. And
so the books were going on at that point?
Yeah. I mean, the books were, you know, started in 2001. And
I didn't realize it was that long. So they've been doing books since, okay, so a while. So, and you don't have involvement or didn't or do or?
Yeah, I mean, I had involvement in kind of the contest portion of it.
Okay.
You know. So I'll give you like a day in the life of Charles in 2003.
Uh-huh.
Was I would literally go to my day job, which was at McGraw-Hill Educational Publishing, and then I would finish the day job and then go to the East Village and then work on Fence for like 3 or 4 hours
Gosh.
A night, and then go back home to Brooklyn. That was like my thing, just to keep the magazine going, and it was... It took its toll, man.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, did you get burned out fairly quickly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, putting in the hours at the day job and then doing Fence at night, and, you know, it was tough. Like, and then Rebecca didn't know, you know, how much commitment she wanted to put in at that point for the magazine, and it was really tough. You know, a lot of the editors were, like I said, we were kind of in flux regarding the poetry and fiction editors. And at that point, it was like, do we keep this going or do we just try to kill it? We didn't know what we wanted at that point.
It started in 98.
It did.
So from the get-go, it was something that people actually read and cared about. So, so you were the managing editor. This is like 05, and you're like, well, maybe we had a good run and maybe this is it.
Yeah, I mean, there was talk of that. You know, I think... honestly, for that issue, the Suicide Girl issue, we had this large backlog of accepted like work at that point, and we were just like, shit, we've got enough for two issues here. Should we do like a double issue? Should we do a summer spectacular? And so we'd actually tried to commission a photo shoot to be like, you know.
Oh.
And that didn't work out well. And
a commission a photo shoot with Suicide Girls?
No, with somebody else completely. Okay. Just to kind of make that, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, summer spectacular, glossy magazine.
Okay.
And that didn't work out well. And then we ended up just like, I ended up contacting the Suicide Girls folks. And they're just like, yeah, you can use some of these images.
Interesting.
And then
it got a lot of outcry, right?
Oh man, we always got hate mail. I mean, that's the thing with Fence. It was, you know, people have really strong opinions about
which is good though. I mean,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
even if somebody hates it, they care.
I mean, that's
the thing that's most important. Because most literary journals, let's face it, I mean,
for sure,
everyone's pleasantly indifferent. I mean, you know,
it's true. I think that's actually what attracted me to them initially was the whole like Steve Evans factory thing. Was just like. All right, what's really the argument here?
Right. No, totally.
And I don't know if you follow that whole thread of...
No, I guess no. The Steve Evans factory, no, what was...
So Steve Evans was like a professor over in Maine, and his whole thing was, you know, what is Fence? Are they trying to commodify blah, blah, blah? Where are they straddling in the...
This is back in the day, or this is...
This is probably like late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay, so no, I don't know. So tell me, yeah.
Yeah, you should...
Steve Evans, okay. No, I don't know. So he was like, where do you fit in?
Yeah, basically. And so there, you know, the outcry initially regarding Fence was, you know, they're trying to... straddle this line between experimental poetry, which, you know, Steve Evans and his folks were kind of trying to claim, and
mm-hmm.
and where do they really fit in the literary landscape, right? And so that was a point of contention for a lot of folks.
Yeah, he published an essay in something.
He did. You know, it's called The Resistible Rise of Fence.
Okay.
You should check.
I will. The Resistible. Maybe we'll link to that.
Yeah.
The Resistible Rise of Fence. Okay.
And that honestly like attracted me to Rebecca and
sure.
Just how she kind of handled that situation. I'm just like, okay, she's got this like really passionate way of articulating what the mission is for this organization she's building. And that really drew me to them.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like there were just all kinds of really interesting like controversies that Fence got embroiled in. I think right. there was like the whole faux tree thing. I don't know if you recall faux tree.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I don't know how we got involved in that.
Alan, what was his last name?
I think it was Alan Cordle. That's the.
Did he live in Oregon?
He did. I think okay. he's. I don't know what that dude's doing now.
Okay, but no, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you some funny stories. Like I think for the longest time we didn't. You know, I was kind of tracking this whole faux tree thing, and I'm like,
"You're in New York."
I was in New York at the time, and then this poet we publish, Andy Mister. I don't know if you know Andy.
Yeah, yeah.
He was not dating Gina at the time, and then they ended up dating, and I'm like, "Is he the faux tree guy?"
And now why him out of all people?
Just I don't know. Like for me, it was just like who? Like I didn't. I was trying to just like. Figure out what the hell was going on because this is before we knew who the whole.
But why? But why would it be him? Because he knew a lot, or why? Or he was.
I don't know him at all.
I read liner notes. I actually like his work.
His work is awesome, man. So Andy and I became really good friends. Like, I think Matthew Rohr really vouched for his work, and then you know, I met him, and we were just like, we feel that I've got this kindred spirit with Andy. I love that guy so much.
But you thought he might have been the poetry guy.
For like a hot second, but then okay. he wasn't. Like the moment like we met together, I'm just like, this isn't the guy. And then like a month later, it was like, oh yeah, this Alan Cordle.
I know, though, that was a big deal back in the day.
Yeah, I think Andy was going to like, I think he was at upstate doing his PhD and I don't know how him and Gina got together, but then he ended up moving down to Brooklyn, and then we became really good friends.
Is he outspoken, or is he just...
Yeah, he was pretty outspoken back in the day. I think he's more involved in social media than he is now, obviously.
So that's maybe why. Well, that was... Yeah. I mean, what was that on? Like Friendster? Like blogs? Just blogs? Because that was pre-Facebook, right?
Yeah. Friendster, that's...
Friendster.
I remember Friendster.
Yeah. I'll friend you on Friendster. all right. Well, in the interest of time, I guess you were in New York for how long?
I was in New York for 5 or 6 years.
Oh, I thought you were there for longer. So you were in New York for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. And then,
okay.
And then ended up moving back to Portland.
Moving back to Portland, and you were managing editor for most of that time.
I was, and then became poetry editor. I think 2007, and then
where you still are.
I still am. I'm still
okay. So you're still poetry editor there, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'll do a quick plug. Like Wordstock is next month, and I'll be manning the Fence booth at Wordstock.
The Portland Book Festival, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But yeah, I'm still doing work for them. And
nice.
You know, it's
changed a lot, but you mean you still have a good relationship with everything? Kind of
for sure, man. I think it's I think where we're going organizationally is pretty fascinating. I mean, you know, we're really at this point. You know, a lot of the editors are bringing in, you know, we're really trying to make a very deliberate movement towards people of color and queer poetry editors, queer editors coming in. And so
editors and writers or I mean, both. Yeah.
Both. Yeah. And, you know, I think that was kind of this initial, you know, desire from the editors is let's be deliberate about how we want to move forward. And so I think, you know, from a diversity and inclusion perspective, we're really trying to do something very, you know, very radical in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I am. I'm really proud of what we're doing. You know, the books we're publishing and, you know, I can't speak highly enough about the authors we're publishing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Does Fence still? I still think I moved and my subscription never followed me. comes out twice a year,
okay.
Biannual. All right. And then I guess last Godspeed You Black Emperor.
Yeah,
why? How are they important to you, or why?
I'm gonna get really like deep here.
Sure,
we had my wife and I had a loss, our first child. Died in 2011.
Okay.
And, you know, it was this really like intense, heavy period in our lives. And I couldn't listen to music. This was 2011. Oh. And
was that the first time that ever happened to you? You couldn't listen to music?
I just couldn't listen to music. It was, I don't know, like anything, especially anything lyrical. I just couldn't deal with people's words and voices, and it was just this really intense period. And Godspeed was like the first like band that I could listen to again. And so, you know, I think 2 months after she had passed away, it was like, okay, I can get back into this. And Godspeed was like,
did you know them before? How did you?
I did. I'd seen them like plenty of times before, and you know, really, really connected with a lot of their albums. And I don't think I had the same emotional connection until after Vivian passed away.
Okay.
And yeah, I think for me, I think for a good like 3 or 4 months, that was all I listened to exclusively.
Was there a particular album or just their whole kind of catalog? I mean, it was all you could really.
Yeah, I mean.
And I mean, just if you could describe Godspeed for people who don't know, like.
I mean, I think, you know, as far as the soundscapes they were creating, it really like gave me a space to think about what was going on internally. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was this really, I don't know how to describe it other than, you know, it gave me a space to think and feel without having to really, without having to process too much.
Right.
And I still like to this day, like will listen to Godspeed and think, my God, what was that weird period after, you know, that really raw grief. And they did, they really helped me get through that period.
It was restorative in some sense.
For sure.
Huh.
Yeah. I think,
and do you listen to them now or you can't really listen to them?
I still do. What's interesting is, you know, I think back in my 20s, I really loved a lot of the early 4AD stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially This Mortal Coil. And there's, I don't know if you have in the CD box set, the fourth disc is the Originals. So it's all the original covers that they were doing.
Oh, no, no.
Oh, I should check it out. It's so amazing, man.
Okay.
It is so amazing. And that was the only progression for me from kind of the instrumental soundscapes to actual lyrical work was that fourth disc from This Mortal Coil. And, you know, so it's like The Apartments and Tim Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
Just resonated with me at that point in my life.
Sure.
Yeah.
Huh.
Sorry to end it on this note, man. It's,
well, no.
It's pretty.
Let's just end with your Ian Savonius story.
So I was this was down in San Diego at UC San Diego. There's a they used to have this venue called the Shea Cafe.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's still there, but it's pretty interesting. And I was there with this girl, and I was just like really interested in, you know, I was really into this girl.
This is late 90s?
This is kind of mid-90s.
Okay, mid-90s.
And I was really into Michelle May at the time. I thought I had kind of a crush on Michelle May.
Uh-huh.
And
who was a singer-songwriter?
Who was the bassist for The Makeup at the time.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
So I'm there with this date, and Ian like rolls up to my date and was just like doing his thing, and,
oh,
and my date's just like, see you later, Charles. I'm all about Ian.
That's hard.
And I'm just like,
Charles.
Oh, man. So then Michelle May was just hanging out by herself, and I just like roll up to Michelle May, and I'm just like, hey, what's going on? So we're just talking. And then Ian sees me talking to Michelle May, and he rolls up to Michelle May and like cock blocks.
To his own basis?
Yeah, and I'm just like, dude, what's Ian got against me? What's going on here?
That's not cool at all.
I know.
That was that it? Yeah, is that, it do he, does he end it. Up cool or that's it? Have you ever?
I don't know if I met him after that, but yeah, he cock blocked me twice that night.
Okay, well, never again. All right.
Okay. Although I still enjoy his music, Chain and the Gang is very enjoyable.
The Makeup are good. Yeah, I don't like. Yeah. Okay. Well. All right. I think we good. You happy?
Yeah, man.
All right. Thank you, Charles.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Buckinger. For more, See our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.